I want to welcome everyone, each and every one of you. I even see some friends and family and appreciate the support. As Brian said, my name is Sarah Shaw and I've been practicing for quite a while. I started with Vipassana, and I would say that most of my training has been through retreats and sesshins. And more recently, probably more retreats with Joan, Roshi Joan Halifax in Upaya, at the Upaya Zen Center, which is in Santa Fe. And I'm joining a chaplaincy program with her and her group for next year. And some of the, my interests are starting a children's sangha here in Flagstaff. And with the COVID situation and moving towards Zoom, I really appreciated being part of People of Color Sanghas. For this talk, I was inspired by a proverb that my father used to tell me when I was a child growing up. He said it often, and along with other ones, but this is the one that really stuck with me. And given that it's inspired by my father, I felt moved to, in this setting of racial unrest and a real desire to understand better racial conflict and white supremacy, that I would include some stories from my father's life and from my life that may just give a little insight into the possible experiences of people of color and certainly into mine. I finished reading recently the book Caste by Isabel Wilkerson, and Asian Americans are considered like the middle caste, and there's a lot of ambivalence around that experience. Following the talk, just so you know what to expect, we'll do a 25 to 30 minute sit with some guidance. We'll have a tiny break before that. We'll have a little longer break after the sitting meditation, and then you're all invited to participate in a discussion afterwards that would be open-ended. So to start with, my parents are both Chinese. So I'm Chinese American, but was born and raised in San Francisco. Both my parents came in the late 1930s, fleeing the violence of the Japanese occupation in southern China. My father was 13 when he came alone on a boat from Hong Kong to San Francisco. My mother, I believe, was 12, and she did come with a few siblings, but no parents. And that was a time when World War II had begun, but the US wasn't participating in it. And I wanna give a few touchstones of racist or immigration policy in the US. In 1882, there was passed in Congress, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And it was the first piece of legislation that excluded and was directed at a specific race. And it was a time when there had been a big influx in immigrants between like 1870 and 1920. There were perhaps 12 million immigrants. And of that number, only about 250,000 were actually Asian. But we had this law excluding all Chinese. And then this was enhanced by the Immigration Act of 1924, which established a quota system for most countries, but also but favored immigrants from Europe, particularly Britain, Ireland, Germany, and Scandinavia, and excluded entirely all immigrants from Asian countries, except for the Philippines, which at that time was a American colony. And that quota system wasn't ended until Lyndon Johnson actually signed the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. So he abolished the quota system and instead put in place a system of preferences that prioritized family reunification and specified skilled labor, I guess. And that really changed a lot. And in fact, my grandmother, my father's mother was able to come after 1965, and spent time on Angel Island, which is dubbed the Ellis Island of the West. And that's in the San Francisco Bay. She spent a few months there. So when my father arrived in San Francisco, he lived in Chinatown, and he lived in a room with 14 men, and he was a young teenager. And he does describe that as a hard time, that he had very little to eat, that there were days when all he had was Lipton soup and white bread. And he grew up in the countryside, so he ate fresh vegetables, fresh fish, fresh snails, you know, on a daily basis. He described that the only time he could heat up soup was during the day on his little electric range, because if he used it at night, the hallway light would dim and the landlord would give them grief about using electricity. He, in his late teens or early 20s, I'm not exactly sure when, got sick and was actually admitted to San Francisco General Hospital in one of those big open wards with multiple beds. And his diagnosis was malnutrition. So nonetheless, he did persevere. He actually got a degree in accounting at UC Berkeley and fought in the Korean War, and then tried to get a job, and he couldn't get a job because he would never be chosen. He'd be in the top three candidates, get his interview, and there was always a white person favored over him, until he applied for work at entry level with the San Francisco City and County, which was a pure meritocracy, and he was able to score highest on the entry level exams, and they had to hire him. And he eventually became a head accountant in San Francisco, supervising the budget for all the different departments. So for me growing up, I would say that I was steeped in the cultural habits of my parents, you know, which was really derived from their childhood. So the type of food, the way we greeted each other, the degree, the kind of talk at the dinner table, the value of education that they had. And I felt it was, I don't know if I felt it was a bubble, but in a sense it was, within a dominant culture. And I would say that I experienced significant racial stress, and I'm not really complaining. It's a common experience of immigrants, because I wasn't sure how to behave when I was out in the dominant culture, when I was in school, how to behave socially. I just was always unsure about that. And I had to do that phenomenon that many immigrant children have to do, which is to some extent parent your parents, because you're the cultural broker for the language. And I would help my father write his letters or memos to his staff or to his bosses. And so there was a dissonance that I was aware of, but I did find my way to a professional life, to a family. And I'd like to share with you a story that where I came to realize the pervasiveness of racial dissonance and or dissonance and discomfort as a result of that racial conflict or feeling like I didn't belong, let's say. And I think belonging and not belonging is a common theme for all of us, depending on the situation and if we reflect. So it's, but there is a particular, I would say, pervasiveness when it comes to being a person of color, because the dominant culture doesn't reflect what may be comforting to you. So there was one evening that I was at a friend's house, and we had children the same age, and my friends are from Singapore, of Chinese descent, and we'd had dinner, we drank green tea together, and then my friend Pin started peeling an orange with a knife. And it was amazing because I suddenly felt this warm feeling in my chest, like really in my, it's radiated throughout my being. And I wondered what's going on? And I realized that he was peeling an orange the way my parents peeled oranges. And I've never seen that outside of my parents' home. And it just was so comforting to see him do the simple act, you know, kind of a daily act, and yet it felt familiar. I felt at home. And it made me realize that there are so many other situations where I feel like I think I'm comfortable, I think I'm good, I'm okay, but it doesn't generate that feeling of being home. And it really gave me an understanding of that pervasiveness of dissonance, I would say, and discomfort. And I think that's what people refer to when they talk about racial stress. That's a subtle example, and there certainly are others that are more uncomfortable. But that was very real. And then another story is one of appropriation. When I was in residency training to be a doctor, we were working, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week. One of my colleagues, also a resident, decided that for Halloween, she would dress up as me. She braided her hair the way I braided my hair. I was braiding it in three braids, and she dressed, I don't really remember how, but in a way that she felt was my style. And I do think she was trying to compliment me, but I have to admit that I felt horrible. I felt like this person who was white and outgoing and certainly dynamic and had a lot of wonderful qualities was, I felt that she thought that she could become me by doing something that was even less than skin deep. And when I look back, I know that she had good intentions, but I think what I regret is that she did not ask me about my experience, didn't ask me about how I felt about that, didn't really look and inquire about what brought me to the place where I had qualities that maybe she admired. And I think in some of the anti-racist literature, and I think Ruth King talks about this in her book called Mindful of Race, that there is intention and impact. And sometimes we're not aware of the impact of our actions. And so I tell the story really in part to invite each of you to think about times when maybe you could have asked a question, could have reached out and learned a little bit more about another person's experience. And I think many of these interracial encounters are awkward, but we can all benefit from that type of conversation. And sorry, I just wanted to see what time it was. Okay. So as I said, the inspiration for the Dharma talk was a proverb that my father told me. And there are many Chinese proverbs, often 4 or 8 characters. This one was a 4-character one. And his English words for the proverb were these: "You cannot taste the sweet until you have tasted the bitter." And I think in Mandarin, he said it in Cantonese, but I looked it up and I believe it's this one. And in Mandarin, it would sound something like this: Ku jin gan lai. You cannot taste the sweet until you have tasted the bitter. And what does this mean? Well, I think it could mean that perhaps you have to experience hardship and bitterness before you can taste the sweet. Could that be true? Do you need to have hardship in order to find joy? Is suffering a path to joy? Is this about delayed gratification? If you Google this, those are the kinds of meanings that come up. And in fact, Rick Reardon, who is an author of a popular series of youth books about that derive some inspiration from Greek mythology, has an Asian character named Frank who speaks this and interprets it as no pain, no gain. But in fact, that's not the message that I got from my father. The message I got was, life is so much sweeter when you have tasted the bitter. In other words, our experience of difficult times, of shame, of anger, of loss, of anxiety, fear. These hard times, when you get to the other side, particularly, you find that they have increased your capacity for joy and for ease, kind of in proportion to that difficult time. And I think that this proverb is really about deep experience, the deep experience of humanity, and ultimately cultivating gratitude, deep gratitude. I really feel that when I practice, when I sit on my cushion and bring myself back to the present moment, and then back again to the present moment, maybe anchoring myself with the breathing or sounds that arise and diminish, I create a space that's with less judgment, with more peace, with more acceptance. And this changes how I hold those experiences that are so difficult, that are painful, that are regretful. And furthermore, in our practice and with our Sangha friends, we can actually share some of these experiences with skill, with mindfulness. We can practice skillful speech, wholehearted listening, and it really does add a richness to our experience. It's really precious to have that opportunity to create that space, to share that space. And I think when we hold an experience and suspend our reactivity, we may be able to feel it more or feel it more fully. And we're really building up a capacity for being there for whatever shows up. And in that space, qualities like peace and equanimity can kind of creep in. And so I would say that this proverb doesn't stand alone, meaning that there are other sources that say the same thing. And I want to share a couple of my favorite ones. One is from Khalil Gibran, which probably most of you or all of you know. He was a Lebanese-American writer at the turn of the 20th century. coming from Lebanon to Boston, and he lived from 1883 to 1931. He was a poet and a writer and is best known for the book, The Prophet. And this is one of his excerpt or one of his chapters. It goes like this. Then a woman said, "Speak to us of joy and sorrow." And he answered, "Your joy is your sorrow unmasked. The self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with tears. How else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. When you are joyous, look deep into your heart, and you shall find it is only that which has given you sorrow that is giving you joy. When you are sorrowful, look again in your heart, and you shall see that in truth you are weeping for that which has been your delight. Some of you say, joy is greater than sorrow. And others say, nay, sorrow is the greater. But I say unto you, they are inseparable. Together they come, and when one sits alone with you at your board, at your table, remember that the other is asleep upon your bed." I was really delighted when I first read this because it did immediately remind me of my father's proverb. And you know, this is something we experience on a weekly basis. It's not really something unusual. If you've had a real physical day, like you went on a long hike or a good bike ride or whatever, or you were just busy and forgot to eat, when you sit down to your meal, you are so hungry, you might say you're starving, even if you're not. And that meal tastes so good. It tastes like nothing you've tasted before. I think we've all had that experience. I certainly have. And it's also the same if you've been away from home for whatever reason, vacation that had bad weather, work, or just a long, long day, and you're just exhausted, and you come home, and it feels so comfortable, or you sleep in your own bed that you haven't slept in a while, and it's like, oh my God, this is heaven. It's the same thing. That hardship carved out your capacity for joy and sweetness. I'd like to share a couple excerpts from Rumi. He, as probably everyone knows, was an early 13th century Persian Sufi mystic and wrote a lot of poems, a lot of beautiful, beautiful poems. And this is one of my favorites. "We are the mirror as well as the face in it. We are tasting the taste this minute of eternity. We are the pain and what cures the pain. We are the sweet cold water and the jar that pours. Here's the new rule. Break the wine glass and fall toward the glass blower's breath." I'll repeat that because I love that line so much. "Break the wine glass and fall toward the glass blower's breath." So here we are, a sangha sharing a bit of our journeys together. And there are many paths and reasons and experiences that bring us to this point, to this present moment. And if you imagine the wine glass as the vessel we carve to make room for all our experiences, for all the range of sorrow, joy, resentment, regret, grief, worry, as well as delight, joy, love. We know that these are all parts of the tapestry of human life. And this wine glass is a beautiful metaphor for holding our experiences, but also not just for cultivating this capacity, but moving towards boundlessness. You know, in Buddhism, well, as you all know, or probably know, we cultivate capacities for loving kindness, karuna, compassion, metta, appreciative joy, mudita, equanimity, upeksha. And I think Brian has talked about some of these qualities in recent talks. And I feel like the Rumi's poem invites us to move, to sort of trust that we can move towards cultivating these in a boundless way, that we can trust that as we cultivate these qualities, they may become boundless sometimes. And it's okay if we do it a little bit at a time, but we can be inspired by this image. So to sum up, I encourage you all to taste deeply the bitter and to taste deeply the sweet. Looking deeply, may you find deep understanding, joy, and ease. I also encourage you to find those moments and encounters where or when you can engage with curiosity and open-heartedness. Learn, for us to learn about each other's experience, and at the same time, consider intention and impact. And I encourage you also to trust that you can cultivate a boundless capacity for the human experience of sorrow and joy. And even doing this a little bit at a time is precious. So I hope this talk has been of service. So to start with, I'm going to, can you hear me? Can you do me some? Okay, thanks. I'm going to invite you to settle down into a comfortable position, lying, sitting, cushion, couch, chair. Take this minute to arrive. I'm going to invite you to feel your body. Find, for me, I like to find a balance point with a relatively straight spine, but relaxed. Think about your shoulders and let them relax and create space between your ear and your shoulders. I suggest considering soft front and strong back. And also feel your body as you sit in contact with your seat. And move on to anchoring yourself either with the breath, chest expansion, abdomen in and out, air moving through your nose, or the sounds around you that come and go. And I will start with a bell and have some quiet meditation for about 5 minutes, and then I'll start a guided meditation. And so if the mind wanders, we bring our mind back to the present moment. We anchor again in our breathing. We're listening to sounds around us, whatever works best for you. If you are so inclined, I invite you to bring your attention to something or someone that was maybe a difficult experience, or where you feel some friction. Bring to mind this person, or perhaps encounter. And it's okay if it feels a little uncomfortable, a little awkward. Things arise, but we can notice perhaps where in our body we feel this encounter, what our response to that encounter or that person is. Just feel where it is and let it be. Ah, this hurts this way. This feels like a loss or a regret. Here it is. And perhaps we can allow it to be and feel a space create around it. Be in touch with our feet on the ground, how we or where we are sitting and connecting on our cushion or on the seat of our chair. We're still here and we are whole. And you may have a sense of the Sangha around you, supporting you in this effort to just be with an uncomfortable place. And you may notice that how you feel about it changes some. It may be a feeling, but it's not really a self or an I. It is an experience. And maybe we can feel a little peace creep in, a sense of spaciousness. Maybe even, I don't like it, but I'm okay. And when you are ready, you can let this go. Maybe you can let it sink into the earth, into Mother Earth's waiting arms. Or you can just let it be, knowing that you can revisit it another time. Maybe it'll feel different again. And again, feel the space that you are in. Attend to your breathing or the sounds around you. Arrive again in this space. And when you are ready, perhaps you can bring to mind something that brings you joy. Something that it could be a person, a flower, an object of beauty, a dog, a cat, but something that brings a smile to your face. Let that come into your heart, fill your being. And notice if you can touch some gratitude around that. How sweet that is. How wonderful. Maybe it's even boundless. And again, feeling spaciousness around this beautiful object, or person, or animal. How sweet it is. And when you are ready, or you may have already, you can let that go and come back to the present moment and breathing or listening. And in a few minutes, we'll do a metta meditation. And now I'd like to invite you to transition a little to a metta meditation. And if you need to adjust posture or position yourself a little differently, feel free. And to start with, let us practice compassion to ourselves. And sometimes it's helpful to imagine something or someone who we associate with easy loving, like a daughter or child or parent or spouse, friend, good friend, or a furry creature. And feel it in your chest, in your heart, a real warm feeling. Even if you receive this from yourself, I invite you to take it in to feel that warmth in your chest and through your body. Sweet lovin'. And if you have that space at this moment, think of that person or being that is easy for you to love and to share compassion with. And perhaps you can use words like, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be joyful. And perhaps extend and expand that feeling to extended family, to friends, to your neighborhood, and further out. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be joyful. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.